Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Short Coat Podcast.
Weird news,
fresh views,
helpful clues and interviews
by students for students.
Subscribe to our weekly show at theshortcoat.com.
It's the Short Coat Podcast. I am your host, Dave Etler. And I'm here today with Cole Chaney.
Hello.
I'm here today with Zi Zhang.
What up?
I'm here today with Greg Woods.
Hi there.
And I'm here today with Corey Christensen.
Hello.
Now, you guys, the folks being educated in medical school don't always get to know the folks at the top of the organization, which is too bad because everybody has their story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, just agree with me.
Especially those people at the top.
Well,
they have a more interesting story oftentimes.
Exactly. I mean, nothing's happened to us yet. Perhaps we can learn from them. With that idea in mind, Cole Chaney decided to talk with our dean here at the Carver College of Medicine, a doctor by the name of Deb Schwinn, anesthesiologist.
Correct. Cardio anesthesiologist.
Oh, so there you go.
Sub specialty.
Dean Schwinn grew up in Ohio, and she went to college there.
Worcester
College. She went on to Stanford Medical School, did her fellowship at Duke, spent the majority of her post-fellowship career there, about 21 years, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness.
And in 2007, she and her family moved to Seattle, where she was chair there.
Correct.
And then she arrived at the Carver College of Medicine in 2012 to be the big dean.
There's a lot of fellowship sub-training chair department, but the big one was Seattle.
It's a long road to
deandom.
Or even like, you know, just getting to cardiology
anesthesiology cardiology focus.
All right.
And that being said too, it's very interesting to see this route of you got to go coast to coast to in the middle, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like you're bouncing back and forth, rising to the top, because dean is a very unique position. If you think about it, how many medical schools are in the United States? 130, 120? Does that sound right? Not a lot.
Like
so it's almost like NFL kicker in terms of how specialized you are.
Wow.
You know?
I don't know if you really want to compare
that's but quarterback.
Why doesn't that work?
Yeah, I liked it. Whatever.
All right.
You just come on the field for like 2 seconds per game.
Oh, yeah.
Tell my uncle the NFL. No, I'm kidding. He didn't do that. But tell that guy. I'm sure he trained. But what I'm saying, it's a very unique position. I think a lot of people don't set out thinking I'm going to be dean of a medical college. But when you get there, you have such a wealth of experience that it actually fits really well. So hopefully, we'll see in the interview.
Does cardiac anesthesiologist mean that she will ease your broken heart pains?
Oh.
Yeah, she touches on that.
That's
help your
nice.
Heartache.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Well, she's a musician by trade, so you'd be interested that she actually does have sort of more insight into the emotional creative side than maybe you'd give some doctors credit for.
Well, let's start with that.
Dean is in a band?
No. Classically trained.
Oh.
Let's hear that. Let's start with that.
So I had my midlife crisis that most people have in their mid-40s. I had it when I was 16. Well, I had decided to go into music and was a very serious violinist. By the time I got to my senior year, I had applied only to conservatories. And in early February, my senior year of high school, I let my dad talk me out of going into music. But he asked some tough questions, you know, and music is a pretty tough career. You have to be very, very focused. The question that I look back at now that was piercing, I had enough insight to ask, but I didn't have enough life experience to be able to answer well. And that is, could I speak with my music? Now, most people who are great artists have had a tough life at some point, and they're speaking sometimes out of their pain, sometimes out of their joy, but they've got enough life experience that they're saying something.
That kind of makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, you know, if you're going to be really super, a super good musician, I mean, I think everybody would agree that super awesome musicians have some emotion to put into it. They're not just technically proficient.
Like Justin Timberlake.
Or Britney Spears.
That's right.
Are there musicians here today?
I played violin for 8 years when I was a child.
So can you sympathize with this ability to synthesize one skill and then apply the same mindset to a very different one?
Well, I think that every day in my job here as a administrative services coordinator, I really try to put my feeling, my very soul, into each email that I compose or each database record that I update.
Saw that coming.
I saw that coming.
I could feel it, Dave.
Anyway, so anybody else here play music?
I won the junior harmonica competition at the state fair when I was like 10.
Wow. Congrats.
So, no.
I do see overlap. So, for example, I think Carver College of Medicine right now is leading the intramurals, right? So, of all the points differential for wins, we're winning because we have the most people and the most sports. And at first, it's sort of like, well, those doctor kids, why are they also doing basketball, baseball, shuffleboard? But then you realize that these are just people who, they have a motor, right? They're people that just do things sort of intensely and with a lot of focus. And that's more of the skill as opposed to the sure. thing itself.
I think we'll hear more about this as we go through this. But one of the things that struck me about Dean Schwinn has to say is that she's very intentional.
Yes.
About the track that she's on, and always has been. So this, you know, sort of examining like, okay, what's going on in my musical career? What do I need to go to the next, you know, what do I need to be awesome at it? I need to make a decision about that. That seems to come out.
She was realistic.
Well, that and just very, yeah, analytical about it, which, you know, I think is an incredible skill to develop.
So another thing that Dean Schwinn touches on, you know, in terms of she had this music interest, but then she realized that her second biggest interest was medicine. Another interesting thing that she's really tried to embrace is interdisciplinary. And I think, you know, that's sort of a vague term. But then what she's actually done is multiple times she's basically trying to take different departments across these universities or these big academic institutions and make them work together. And the word she uses is orthogonal, which I thought was really interesting. I think here she talks about working with the College of Business, but
Engineering.
Engineering, pardon me.
Here we go.
I love interdisciplinary work, but it's because it's very clear that if you have people from different disciplines in a room together thinking about a common problem, you're going to come up with a better solution than if you're just thinking independently along the line you've been trained. Trying to figure out a DNA-based malarial diagnostic that could be used in the middle of Africa with very low cost and no refrigeration, it's a tough project. Mm-hmm. Those engineering students would come in and try to do things that they had no idea what they were doing. And our science people would say, wait a minute, you have to kind of try this first, preliminary data, and then do it. And I learned the word orthogonal, which is 90 degree angle, essentially. And so people thinking perpendicular to yourself. And I thought it was wonderful. Because here we were probably too cozy with our methods in science, and the engineers were probably too naive to know that they didn't know what they didn't know. They were just going to try it, and if it worked, great. They didn't care how or why. They were engineers. It was functional. And it was a wonderful blending of minds that we had that whole year. It was great.
So, yeah, this is a interdisciplinary research, big buzzword these days as far as, you know, at least colleges of medicine, I think. We hear it all the time here. But what's cool about it is, you know, like one discipline sort of, you know, gets together with another discipline. They cross-pollinate and things happen that... Stop smiling, Z. I know what you're thinking. But the point is that, like I read the story the other day about the use of polio viruses to cure glioblastoma, which, if you don't know what that is, it's a horrible brain cancer that basically you get it and you're dead within, you know, a very short amount of time. I mean, we didn't have a cure for it.
You should write a greeting card.
But it's a very, I mean, it's a very, you know, sort of horrible disease that, you know, we just didn't have any sort of real cure for. I mean, they could give you radiation that would extend your life for a certain amount of time, but it keeps spreading and then, you know,
you're dead.
Sadsies. But the point, so what they did was they took this, you know, so I'm sure like a whole, they didn't talk about this, but I'm sure like a whole bunch of different disciplines got together and said, hey, what if we use a polio virus to nuke glioblastoma, you know? Mm-hmm. And
basically
I didn't
act as a vector to get the immune system to attack it.
Yes, exactly. And it seems to have worked pretty well. I mean, people who, you know, did not have, you know, people who, you know, they couldn't say, you know, yeah, we're going to shrink your tumor. Suddenly the tumors were being destroyed, which is amazing. So, you know, that sort of thing, I think happens, has a lot of places to go. Boy, that was a long...
I think also it's a good model.
I could have said that shorter.
For how a hospital should be run, because we hear about this in class, is that you want to be working between the different areas of the hospital. You don't just want to, you know, keep one thing together, especially if it's vexing you and you can't come up with something. Reach out to others and try to get a lot of people working on this. And through different specialties, through different bits of knowledge that random people might have, you can come up with better solutions that way. And it's not, you know, not the ideal in every case, but it's something that that we should utilize more.
You can see that in oncology care. They have tumor board at mm-hmm. the hospital, and you bring in, you know, the oncologists, the surgeons, nurse practitioners, social workers, and everyone kind of sits down and hashes out each patient's case, and you do your planning ahead of time with the whole group on board. Or, you know, for babies who have birth defects that are detected in utero, you can get the neonatologists and the pediatric surgeons and the obstetricians, and everyone comes together to discuss it and be ready.
And the applying of this is also really, I think it's challenging, because the same thing that got a lot of these medical professionals who are at the top of their career to where they are is a fierce independence, a self-reliance. And, you know, they've definitely asked for help, but there's been a lot of like self-sufficient starting there. And so to be able to say like, you know what, I'm dumb in this field and I need help in this area. And that's a huge maturity step that I think mm-hmm. I'm not there yet. I just see people I admire doing it. So I'd like to incorporate more.
So you mean you're still like, I know everything?
Doesn't play well with others.
Yeah, or if I don't know
it. I noticed that about you, Cole.
It's not worth knowing, right? It's a bad trait, and that's why you see these people who really do great things, and there's a lot of other people coming in, and there's a lot of seeding of power.
Do you think the nature of medical school fosters that, or makes it worse?
Because it's all personal tests and personal benchmarks, but you have to have that too. So I don't know. Mm-hmm. Do we add something else? I mean, we tried to have an IPE event, and I think it didn't go very well. You know, we tried to, IPE stands for interprofessional
education.
Yep. Yeah. And it wasn't necessarily really embraced, I'd say, by most of the different colleges here. So,
well, I they're working on it. I think the issue, maybe, I'm not really sure what the issue is. I suspect it might be one of time. I mean, in medical school, you know, there's 4 years, which probably goes by in like a flash with you guys. But at the same time, it's 4 years, whereas some of the other colleges, you know, you've got 2 years, mm-hmm. maybe even 18 months.
Condensed.
I mean, it's mm-hmm. there's not a lot of time for them to sort of carve out for this sort of, you know, discussion between the professions. But mm-hmm. I like the fact that they're working on it. I mean, you know, it's they've got some things to do, but it kind of makes sense.
What next topic, Dave? You're the commander here.
Well, she talks about how collaborative we are here at Iowa. Mm-hmm. So here we go.
The culture is different at every institution. This is a very collaborative culture, so you can trust across the board. There is a lot of integrity, and I've never worked in an institution that has really better individuals in that regard. And that's one of the things that attracted me to Iowa in the first place.
What do you guys think of that?
Yay us.
I mean, do you think that that's... Do you get the feeling that that's true?
I'm not at the level. When she said it, kind of... It felt like she's worked at some world-class institutions. I'm sure they all collaborate well. So that's... I don't really know.
I trust her opinion there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I was thinking about, you know, this whole curriculum
change,
redesign that we went through, and how, you know, it could easily be that, you know, everybody fought each other about the topics that would be discussed and I'm sure there was, you know, a lot of, you know, back and forth about this sort of thing. But at the same time, what I've noticed maybe from where I sit is that they really have been working hard together to sort of put this curriculum together here. Mm-hmm. So if you don't know what I'm talking about out there, you know, they decided to sort of at the behest of the accreditation body that deals with medical schools, or at the suggestion, is they started integrating, like really super integrating, the basic sciences and the clinical sciences, and you know, really smashing them all together to sort of bring a more cohesive whole. So there wasn't that division between basic science and clinical.
Well, the best example I can think of is I learned, so mine was the old curriculum where I learned anatomy of the heart my first semester. I learned sort of the biochemistry and the function and physiology of the heart my second semester. And then third semester, I learned how certain drugs interact with the heart. And then fourth semester, I learned how an EKG can interpret all of these changes in the heart. And my understanding is when I talk to the M1s now, they're doing all of this in the same class on the same week.
Yeah, and then they revisit these topics from a sort of a different angle later in the curriculum. I think there's like something like 18 common illnesses that they've sort of integrate into their, or common afflictions or common diseases that they've integrated into the curriculum to help illustrate these points. But the point is that, you know, they are all, you know, these course directors, these strand directors, they call them, they're all working very much, very closely together to sort of make sure that, this sort of information is passed on to the med students in a way that makes sense. And it's a huge project. And there could have been a lot of infighting. There could have been a lot of like, you know, my thing is more important than your thing. And my understanding is that that hasn't happened. So I guess that's in support of what she's saying. Here she talks about how not to listen to your mentor, which I thought was interesting.
I give a lecture nowadays, or at least I did in the last 5 or 6 years, called How Not to Listen to Your Mentor. And people think, whoa, that's so odd. But what it means is it's important to get the input of 5 or 6 people that you trust. Recognize that their life, they did what they wanted to do, and they're giving you the very best advice that they can based on their own experience. But if you're going to take a path that's different, then their advice is only going to go so far.
So I think what she's saying there is you've got to, you know, no matter what your advisors have to say to you, you've got to decide what your path is going to be and then go for it. What do you think? Do you have a mentor, Z?
I think I have a couple of different mentors, and it just depends on the different experiences that you pick in medical school. I definitely agree with what Dean Schwinn is saying. I think it's really wise to not exactly retrace one person's steps, but to gather the different wisdom from different places that other people have too, so you can forge your own path. I guess
there's such a thing as an inverse mentor, somebody who shows
you're
you
like,
how
I don't want to do that.
Shows you how not this. Shows you how not to be
Jersey Shore.
Yes, the situation. I think we can.
That's my inverse mentor.
I mean, that's. I feel like it's a valid thing to say, you know, because there certainly are people out there who can show us how not to live our lives.
It's tough with the medical environment is changing a lot, and so any advice you get has to be taken, I think, with a huge grain of salt. There's certain truths that are going to permeate throughout time, culture, etc. But a lot of certain tips, more specific to finding the right residency, choosing the right career, that's all kind of gone out the window. And so I think you can maybe take the greater goal they're giving you, but you really can't focus on the minutiae of what they tell you.
And they're advisors. They advise. They don't dictate and tell you what you have to do. They're there to help you figure out the steps along the way.
She had some something interesting to say about residents going into private practice versus residents going into academic medicine, yeah. The path that she took. And I'm wondering, what I couldn't tell from your discussion was whether this was sort of up to date.
Yeah.
Or whether this, you know, so, but I think it's a valid question anyway, or valid point anyway. So let's listen to this.
I found it fascinating that residents would go into private practice because they felt they had a lot of debt and they wanted to pay off their debt. But if in fact they had an academic interest in one of the areas that NIH would fund debt repayment because they were doing some sort of research related to clinical activity, let's say pediatrics, for example, is a good example, they could get debt repayment grants. And if they got those, depending on their specialty and the length of training and how much they could earn as a fellow versus a private practitioner, and none of them had actually done the math to see that if you got your loans paid for, you know, over the next 2 years, that in fact you made money, or at least didn't lose money in doing the academic route where your heart may really resonate.
So, and she said certain fields are, and this is more modern, so she wasn't just saying previously, she's saying even going forward, she said like places like pediatrics, oncology, there were certain areas she felt like this was still the case, and other areas where this didn't apply at all.
We just kind of learned about this. We had a debt management seminar, which was really scary to hear. But
it's a good time for that after you've gotten your...
I know, like bring us crashing down after our match. But they talked about how if you work for a public institution like a university, I think after 10 years, you can have some of your loans forgiven. So I think something to think about.
Yeah. You know, I think there's this idea that you have to make money after you graduate. And I guess that's important. You know, we kind of need money for food and clothing and, you know.
All right, Maslow.
They want you to wear pants when you come to. Yes,
dang,
thank you.
They're uptight.
But at the same time, you know, like there's more to consider than that. And you can consider it if you're, I don't know, sufficiently motivated. Right?
Yeah. And if you've done some planning.
Well, and this is a Dean Schwinn thing in general, is she's looking at issues, I think, more deeply and a bit more broadly, right? So, you know, both far above the trees and very close to the bark. And that's what brought her to this conclusion, because she, I think, in her mentorship, had seen so many kids that came in and they thought, private practice, dollar sign, done.
Yep.
And she said it's like such a more complex issue than that. And I think that was the beauty of her mentorship, is let's take a look at this from another angle, you know? Mm-hmm.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a second.
The Art of Medicine podcast explores topics in medicine through the lens of the arts and social sciences. Learn about an epileptic woman who created a virtual reality grand mal seizure, what doctors can learn from jazz musicians, and the experience of sexual assignment in a medicalized body. Download us on iTunes and visit us at www.theartofmedicinepodcast.com. We are a member of the Vocalis Network, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at Vocalis Network. .wix.com/listen.
We're back on the Short Code Podcast. Go ahead, Cole. What's next?
Yeah, I want to talk. I think so. Dean Schwinn was the first female dean of the Carver College of Medicine, which was a big deal. Although University of Iowa has a pretty good history of, I think, amongst the first female law students. We sort of, there have been a few efforts, I think, to make sure that there's gender equality.
Didn't we have first female doctors here too?
That is my
understanding. Some of the early classes,
something with suffrage too.
Yeah. So, well, let's do this one.
When I went to Stanford, I went from being three women out of 27 chemistry majors in my undergraduate to a medical school class that had 40% women. And this was 1979. We graduated in 1983. So it was just in the cusp where women were coming up in higher percentages in medical school. But what was fascinating, again, we asked each other questions and discovered about 6 months into it that every single woman in my class was either the oldest daughter in her family, the only child in her family, or from a family of only girls. I just think that's fascinating. And if you look back and reflect on that, what could that be from? Well, it could be that the father of the family didn't have any sons. And so everything, all the expectations came to the daughter. Who knows? And that may or may not be the same today. But it sure was tempting to make those kinds of assumptions.
Z, I understand you're a lady.
You are correct.
And I understand that you're an only child.
Both correct.
What do you have to say about this idea? What's your scientific appreciation of this? I have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm doing, you know, like, this is like
Z-talk.
The one, I just was, this is the one podcast where I actually want to do well.
There's so much pressure, Dave.
That explains a lot of the other ones.
Go ahead.
I guess I am shouldering all the expectations of my gender and my entire family and all my ancestors? No.
Do you
think that's true?
Like, wow.
You're really serious.
You're serious.
Do you feel pressure, though?
That's racist. No, I'm just joking. No, I think my parents were... So, my friend says that I had panda parents, not tiger parents.
Oh.
So, they just wanted me to be happy, and they thought that medicine would be suitable for me, I guess. I was going to be a journalist, and then I was like, well...
Were they okay with that?
They were okay with that. I think they thought they would have to pay for a lot more things if I stayed in journalism, but...
But if you go into medicine, it's easy
then stuff. Maybe they
they'll be like, well, that, you made that choice, idiot. You're
yeah, no pressure at all, Z. No, I'm just kidding. They were really supportive of what I wanted to do.
Okay. Do you feel like this would have been different with, say, you had male siblings? Or, you know, I realize it's really hard to speculate, but...
It doesn't sound like it. It doesn't sound like it to hear you say it.
I don't have any... So the only other physician in my family is my aunt. Hmm. So another woman. And let me think. Two nurses in the family, also women. So I think the men in my family just... We're squeamish or something, and they're stayed away from the medical profession.
Underachievers, maybe.
I don't know. I don't think they like blood.
Okay.
Either way, I think it was interesting, and it's a different era too that Dean Schwinn saw this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so now I think it's, you know, women in professional. You know, I think they dominate higher academics at this point. Women are a greater percentage, so it's very different from what she saw. Whereas maybe that was being unique, being someone who was going to a field that maybe did not traditionally have your gender. Now it's maybe less of a case.
Did Dean Schwinn talk about which specialties her female classmates went into?
I don't think she did.
It's a very specific question. So
well, I think it's interesting because while there are a lot of women who are graduating from medical school, I mean, I think equal numbers or maybe even a little bit more than men. It's interesting because they're overrepresented in certain specialties and underrepresented in others.
Which specialties can you...
So, I mean, I'm going into obstetrics and gynecology.
Okay.
So right now the profession is actively trying to recruit more men.
Right. And that wasn't always the case, I think.
That was not always the case. Mm-hmm. It's up and down because a lot of the older physicians, I mean, I guess more physicians went, in general were male. So a lot of the older obstetricians were male. And now they're trying to bring them back.
Interesting.
Yeah. But then if you look at some of the surgical specialties, I think, you know, orthopedics doesn't traditionally have many women going into it.
Why do you think that is?
Interesting. I don't know. I think some of it has to do with the duration of training.
You give up a lot to do all that time. What's the duration like in orthopedics?
I think ortho is 5 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think urology is 5 years. General surgery is 5 years. My program is 4 years. And then, you know, general medicine, like family medicine, internal medicine, and pediatrics are 3. And I do think that there are more women going into those specialties.
Are you doing because of childbearing issues? Is that what you're trying to get at?
Or family issues?
Family.
And, yeah. Child, that's what not I've childbearing. Heard anecdotally. Not actually bearing the children. I mean, you know.
Yeah. Child related, though. Is that.
Family related, yeah.
You didn't say it, so I'm trying to clarify why a woman would want maybe a shorter duration of training.
I think for some people that is important, and I've heard that from some classmates. But again, just
something they think about.
Something to think about. There were 2 classmates I can think of who were trying to time their, you know, reproductive cycle with the interview cycle. You know, I would like to have a child before I start residency, but I don't want it to be obvious when I'm on the interview trail. So through some kind of black magic voodoo, you know, they managed to time it perfectly.
Is that what you call it?
As a future obstetrician, yes.
Black magic voodoo.
That's right.
Wow. Well, here's what she has to say about being the first Carver College of Medicine dean who's a woman.
Well, first of all, I've felt very welcomed here ever since day one. I don't think there's been anything other than support that I felt at Iowa, not just within our own college and our UI healthcare, but also across campus. We happen to have 50%, or when I arrived, and we're close to 50% now, of the deans of various colleges across this campus are women. But more importantly, there still is a different dance for women and male leaders. Certain things that show a strong male leader would not be considered that most people would think of as a strong, good female leader. For example, someone can be very brash and aggressive, and that's seen very differently for men than it is for women. You can be conciliatory, and that be seen as an extra quality that might be of extra strength in a man, might be expected in a woman. But that's true all throughout life. Those are the balancing things you have to take care of all throughout life. They don't hold you back. When you enter a job where everything you say is looked at from 360 different degrees, you just have to be a little more careful. And I've learned that. I'm a pretty open person, and sometimes, you know, being less open is better. but in general, like I said, I felt so welcomed. So I've not felt limited in any way.
Well, that's nice.
This issue, I could just talk about this forever.
Well, go for it.
Start. Just like opened up a can of worms. But it's always just hard to make generalizations about, you know, what's the reproductive urge, or, you know, am I just running out of eggs and I want to reproduce, versus what the system that exists and the structures that are in place, you know, like how are residencies supporting time off for mothers versus fathers? And this varies by specialty. Or, you know, who are the people making the rules? Maybe they tend to be more of the older men who were in medicine a lot earlier and they grew up in a different system. I think even in the match system, it's very hard now for, you know, men and women to function in this very old-fashioned system. Because I think in the past, with the match, you know, more men were in medicine and then their family would just follow them to wherever they matched to, wherever they ended up. But, you know, with more women going into medicine, everything has to change. I mean, I think overall my point is it's hard to fit all these new people and new ideas into the same old existing structure. But I think a lot of schools are working on it, just not quite there yet. Not ideal.
Sure. I think, you know, systems respond to pressure, you know, and the pressure in this situation and what you're talking about is the, you know, residents who may or may not want to apply to your specialty or your program, whatever it is, you know. And so, you know, that's the way that the system changes is by, you know, people saying, well, I don't want to apply to your system. I don't want to apply to your program if you're going to not treat me in a certain way.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, it was interesting to hear her talk about, you know, sort of the accommodation that you may need to make. I don't think she was saying that, you know, you must compromise your ideals, but I think she was saying that, you know, it's something that you have to navigate. You can't just like,
yeah,
blow through it and, right? Is that, what did you think I interpreted?
Well, what I got out of that too, and what you're saying, which is particularly interesting, is, you know, medicine's seen as a sacrificial career in that you have to throw a lot of your time, energy, even maybe your sort of mental health to do a good job because the hours are long, they're stressful, you get called in late at night. But there's a different price of sacrificing for a man versus a woman in that a man with a family and maybe the traditional medicine sense, he can sacrifice himself and still have the kids and have the wife. And to ask the same sacrifice of a woman, that might require her not having any kids. And that's a very different price when we say for personal sacrifice. And so that's why I think, to your point, the fact that the system is like, no, we ask the same sacrifice from everyone. Well, yeah, asking the same hours from two different people with two different reproductive abilities, that's not the same price. And that's, I've never even thought of it that way.
That's a good way to put it, Cole, I think. Yeah, I think you're right that everyone is giving up something different. And you can even take a step back and say, why is it like this? Like, why is it in America that working in medicine requires this many hours, whereas working in Western Europe or a different country where they train more physicians, you know, my aunt says that they didn't have to, she was an otolaryngologist, and even for a surgical specialty, they trained so many more people that it was not necessary to start rounding at 4 a.m. You know, they could go to work at like 6:30 and really
sleep in.
That's
insane. Yeah. How is that even possible?
I know, it's absurd. So I don't know, like if you look at the problems that exist, you can just take it back so many steps. But I think it's important to do that, to not just get blinders on and say, well, I've solved this problem for me and my family, but we should work together to address some of the systematic changes that need to happen.
Can you also address I think she brought up the traits thing, and I think the classic word is bossy. You remember that big campaign a while back where, you know,
B word.
Well, a young aggressive boy is seen as like assertive, yeah, whereas a young aggressive female seen as bossy.
Definitely.
Do you think this is a real thing?
It's such a thing.
Okay.
I just finished reading Bossy Pants by Tina Fey. I don't know if you guys have read that.
I haven't read it.
But in one of the earliest chapters, she just talks about, you know, I found out that being a boss is not just going around waving your hand saying, I'm the boss, I'm the boss, which is what she thought as a little girl.
I think that's what my daughter thinks.
Well,
she's practicing.
Good for her. But yeah, I agree. I think that even what I've seen among our classmates, like sometimes we give a harder time to, you know, a lecturer who's a woman and who has very high expectations, let's say. I don't know. I've just heard a lot of, well, maybe not a lot, but I've heard people say like, oh, you know, she's such a B word. She's so unpleasant. She's so bossy. And I just feel like we immediately raise our hackles and freak out when a woman in a position of authority has something to say.
And maybe if it was a man, we would go, well, this guy's really challenging.
Yeah, right. A little crotchety, mm-hmm, but he's, yeah.
Right. Or, you know, oh, lovably crotchety. Like, oh, he's just tough, but still great. I don't know. It's just the gut feeling that I had from some of the lectures that we've had or seeing how some of my classmates have reacted.
Right. Well, she's not above using perceptions of her gender to accomplish things. So let's hear this.
When I was a chair, I actually used being a female leader to my advantage. When I arrived, we had two female chairs out of like 32 chairs. And there had only been four female chairs of an academic program at University of Washington in the history of the school when I had arrived. I decided to start a wine tasting that happened to be right after the meeting where we all met as chairs with the dean. And it was a wonderful time to get to know each other. People said, you're going to be fired. Well, it was a social event. And I kept saying, I'm a woman. We do social things. So we just did it. And we really accomplished good things. We helped fix the IRB. We probably put 24 new physicians on the IRB at University of Washington. We had 5 IRBs. We put 1 physician per department plus 1 physician per 100 faculty. It was amazing. Same thing with diversity initiatives. We learned from each other best practice. And it went on for clinical things if we had difficulties. So I think sometimes men and women can work together in collaboration using unique skills and unique kind of backgrounds that can just make everything better.
Wine tasting. I think that it's always a good idea to get wine involved.
Did she mean that only the 4 women chairs were invited to the wine tasting?
No, I think they all go to the wine tasting. That was the
point. I don't know.
An exclusive party.
Well, I didn't know what made that especially a female thing.
I think what she was saying is that, you know, to sort of get people together in this way was unusual maybe at the time. And to, you know, sort of have it be more of a social event rather than, you know, let's have a meeting.
So a feminine touch.
Yeah.
But still equally as effective and, you know, because wine tasting maybe not traditionally seen as a problem solving scenario.
Right.
What are you talking about?
Depends on the problem.
Are you in medical school?
That's what she just, I mean, she proved it and maybe you've proven it too. I don't know how you study.
It is a wonderful problem solving method.
I don't remember anything after. That's the problem.
Here she is talking about her mentor, who sounds like a pretty interesting guy.
I would say Ted Williams was a major mentor of mine. He was an amazing man. He was a chemistry faculty member. He was a minority in a town that didn't have very many minorities. And he was an avid musician. So he knew everybody in the music scene in Cleveland, which is about 45 minutes away from the College of Worcester. And he had a gift where he would see students, how they were doing, but he would then take you on a walk around this long block. And by the time you finished the block, you'd opened up to him, and he really worked hard with students to make the future possible. So he came up to me one day and said, you're not happy. And I said, no, I'm fine, I'm happy. And he said, no, you're not happy. Let's take a walk. So we did this famous walk around the block, and about halfway around the block, I said, I'm sorry, but we're between violin teachers here, and I know I'm here from chemistry, but I miss my violin. And he said, let me see what I can do. So he not only found somebody through his music connections, who was the second violinist in the Cleveland Orchestra, I didn't have a car. He found the dean of students' daughter was taking guitar lessons at Cleveland Institute of Music on Saturday mornings. So they gave me a ride up, dropped me off. I had my lesson, she had hers, and they brought me back. And by noon, I'd had my good lesson. And we did that every Saturday throughout college after that. And it was Ted Williams, my mentor in chemistry. And he was a hard chemistry professor, but a great teacher. And to me, that always stood out because he cared enough to think about the other things that made a difference.
Neat guy.
Yeah. What I like about it is that, not, you know, I think we'd all love to have a mentor like that, you know, somebody who, you know, sort of looks at us and sees us as an entire person rather than as somebody who just does chemistry or medicine or whatever it is you're studying. And I don't know. I suspect that's a rare talent.
And maybe it leads back to what Dean Schwinn was saying, that sometimes you need to draw from different sources for inspiration and support so that you get someone looking out for you in different aspects. Mm-hmm.
She has this advice for folks in your position.
So I would say don't ever let anybody tell you you can't. Okay. That's not to say you don't have to work hard, sometimes harder than the person next to you, but anything's possible.
Sometimes harder than the person next to you.
Competitive.
Right? I mean... What are you pointing? You're saying I don't work very hard?
I thought that's an interesting insight, though, because we are in this sort of, one would say, trophy generation, but even med school's adopted a very collaborative approach, and that kind of flies in the face, not flies in the face, but it's saying, like, be aware of the people around you and maybe even outdo them. In my mind, you know, competition's not all bad, I guess.
I think she's also saying that some people just don't have to work as hard to do things, but that doesn't mean that it's any less attainable for you. You might have to work a little bit harder.
True.
But the same goal is within reach.
Mm-hmm. Well, I am... She had this sort of final word about what's been happening lately here at the Carver College of Medicine in terms of new stuff.
So we have a great new medical school curriculum, the New Horizons curriculum. And I know that you have had a taste of it, but the first year class this year got the full curriculum. And it's rolled out well. I mean, every new curriculum has its bumps here and there. But this first year class has been terrific in terms of being flexible and working with us in that regard. Chris Cooper is our associate dean for medical school curriculum and student affairs. And he's just done a fabulous job with a whole group of faculty that have been working for the last 3 to 5 years on this. And so that's a huge major initiative. Another one is, when I came, there were already interprofessional initiatives ongoing, but I really have tried to help support those initiatives and to help them grow. And our health science deans are tremendous in terms of wanting to jump on board and really work on that. And then the third thing I'd say is in research, in the last year, we've really had lots of discussions across our faculty to say, where can we take our faculty and group ourselves into, I mean, what would make sense in terms of groupings so that we can begin to bring people that are strong already even closer together, even in close proximity now that we have the new PBDB building. If we have programs of research, we can bring people into physical proximity so that they can interact with each other and be those 6 or 8 different minds looking at a question or two together. Because that synergy, I think, is important for the future of medicine. And so we've been able to identify some of those research programs that we can then move forward.
You know, I didn't need to be won over, I think, but just her ability to say PBDB, like fluently.
As we look at it.
I think is you know, commendable. But I still can't say it.
I like it. It sounds like an adorable little robot.
The newest droid in Star Wars.
That's yeah. Right.
Me, me, me.
So, yeah, I guess that's all we have for today. Mm-hmm. I want to thank Dean Schwinn for taking the time out to talk with Cole and for agreeing to be on this show. And any final words you want to say, Cole?
If you have anyone else you are interested in, I'm going to try to make this a traveling podcast. Dean's After Dark, but hopefully maybe local. I'd like to keep in the Iowa City area, but I'd love to start interviewing people. And you know what's cool?
Yeah, we don't have a budget for you to go anywhere else.
People comply. If you ask, though, like people who you're like, they'll never talk to you. They'll maybe give you a phoner for 10 minutes. Like, sure. So if you have ideas, send them my way. I'd love to try to do some more of these.
Very good. Thank you guys for joining me today.
You bet. It was fun.
All right. If you like what you heard today on the Short Code Podcast, be sure to visit us at theshortcode.com/tell us and leave us a message there, because we like to hear from you. If something wonderful or strange happened to you, if you're annoyed or pleased about something, or if you want to suggest a story idea to us, that's how you should do it. Do follow and talk to us on Twitter so we can all stay up to date on what's happening at the margins of medicine. The show is made possible by this world we live in and a generous donation by the Carver College of Medicine student government and the Writing and Humanities Program. Our executive producer is Jason Lewis. Our intern is Corey Christensen. Our opening music is by Dr. Vox, and our closing music is by C2C. Talk to you in 1 week.